Good evening. It's 6:06. I'm Doug Nadvornik, and tonight is the last of our discussions about homelessness. In just about 55 minutes, we'll air the second hour of Steve Jackson's town hall forum from last week, Confronting Homelessness, at Spokane City Hall. Among the guests, Spokane City Councilwoman Kate Burke and Mark Richard from the Downtown Spokane Partnership. Also a discussion about housing options. They got into tiny houses, among other things, and so that's an interesting hour that you'll want to tune in for. This hour, though, we welcome into our studio three guests who we've not had in our studio before. Actually, two guests, because Joe Ader, who is the president of the Spokane Homeless Coalition, was not able to join us tonight at a family situation. We wish him the best with that and hope to get him on a little bit later on. So Marie Smith, who is the executive director of the Spokane Homeless Coalition, is with us. David Lewis, who is the Homeless Management Information Systems Manager for the City of Spokane's Community Housing and Human Services Department. And now I'll take a breath after that title. Here to talk about homelessness issues, we invite you to join us sometime this hour at 328-5729. We'll try to get to a few phone calls this hour. Now, we'll get to Maurice because he's doing a film about homelessness, as you've been working on one, and we'll ask you about that. But I'm interested because David and I met for the first time about a couple of months ago. It was at the Truth Ministry mm-hmm. Shelter, and you and Tisha Danzig from the city were there as part of the homeless count. It was the first night of the homeless count. You had your laptop out on a table, and so I was asking you, what are you doing with this? And so this you've kind of gone high tech when it comes to counting homeless people. Tell us about that.
Well, yes. I mean, I think we're always looking for ways of innovating and doing a better job of executing our point in time count. So this was our second year using mobile technology to do that, to have an app on a smartphone that greatly cuts down on the time it takes to process all the surveys we get. And one of the nice features about that, which is what I was doing at Truth Ministries that night, is it allows us in real time to see where surveys are being done, so that we can evaluate in real time. Do we have teams deployed to the right locations? Are we seeing results that maybe could be underlying data quality problems? So it gives us a much more flexible way rather than the old method of collecting it on paper, and then we would all have them turned into the city and have to hand enter them. This is our second year doing it. I don't see us changing. If anything, it's an iterative process. We're going to continue to look for ways of improving on that and doing better.
So that night you had a few volunteers who were there, and they had their little iPads, and they were mm-hmm. sitting at little round tables, and they'd corralled some of the men who were there for the night. And so
Or they had their little smartphones.
The
little app on the smartphone
And they were filling it all out, and they were punching it all out. And so were you getting the information kind of real time?
Yes, I was in fact getting it in real time. So the minute that survey is completed, we can view it in what's called the command center, which is where all that data comes through, and we get a GIS layer, so we can see map of the city where those surveys are being done, which of course plays into the planning for next year's PIT and subsequent point in time counts, because we could see this is where the concentrations were, this is where we need to send the most volunteers, which also leads into service planning too. This is, hey, maybe where we need to think more about positioning services.
So did you feel like doing that and having a small army of folks around, that you had a better idea of, you missed fewer people, so to speak?
Yeah, that's one of the big questions, right? And I think that we did a good job. I think that we did everything we could to get as close as possible to an accurate count. Am I ever going to say that we counted every single person experiencing homelessness? No, I'm not. There's also the question of differing definitions that we have to deal with. The Department of Education has a very different definition of what constitutes as homeless. So when we're trying to reconcile the data we collect through our point-in-time count process, and then we get the information from the schools, they're going to report very different numbers than us as a result of that. And I think that understandably creates some confusion.
Maurice, let's talk about the Spokane Homeless Coalition. Tell us about the organization.
We are we're a gathering of service providers and of interested people who want to address homelessness. I've been in and out of the coalition since really 2005 when I co-founded Feed Spokane, because I used to go to the meetings and give reports on how much food we rescued and where it was going and so forth. So I've been in and out of the coalition for a number of years. And then about 4 years ago, they asked if I would be interested in serving on the leadership team. And so my official title, if Joe is listening, Joe Wader is the coalition chair. You described me as the executive director. Joe went, oh, he got a promotion. I'm the Joe's the chair. Wonderful lady by the name of Eileen Lupert at the Spokane Valley Library is the co-chair. And then Becky Tuno from the city, she and I vie for number three on the totem pole.
Okay.
And Becky is our administrator, and I'm the media liaison. So I do things like this.
So we will then correct the record.
That's okay. The coalition consists of three or four things. One is we have a monthly meeting. First Thursday of every month, we meet at the Gathering House in North Spokane. Post and Garland is the intersection at the Gathering House there. Pastor Rob Bryson opens up to us and hosts. Well, last meeting was between 125 and 150 people. I have 874 people on my Google group list to serve. That's how the coalition talks to each other, and people put out questions. For example, I saw a question come in this afternoon from a gal who is with the HEART program, Public Schools. Mm-hmm. And she said, where can I get a bank account for an unattended or unaccompanied minor who wants to open up a bank account? And I literally had subscribed her about 2 hours earlier. She immediately used her new subscription to the list to put that question out. And before the day was over, she had the answer. And she put out to everybody, this is the credit union that will do that. And so that's what we do among service providers, because none of us know how to fix every problem. And so this is how service providers can talk to each other and say, here's the issue I've got. Has anybody faced this before? And usually within a matter of a few hours, there's half a dozen responses and people saying, okay, here's how you do that. And that is a tremendous service. I got an email today from a gal who said, I hope I'm not using the list too much. But I wrote her back and said, this is what we do. We help each other solve problems. And I think it's a demonstration of what a city can do. That is, if we collaborate rather than confront, we can get a lot more done. And so we talk to each other. How do you solve this problem? How do you solve that problem? What do you do when you're dealing with this kind of a person? And there's enough wisdom on that list, because you've got Catholic Charities, you've got UGM, Union Gospel Mission, you've got VOA, you've got Frontier Behavioral Health. We've got over 200 agencies, ministries, churches on the list. Like I said, 870 plus people. Somewhere on that list, there's an answer to that question. And so it's a demonstration of what happens when a community talks and says, here's the problem. Anybody got any ideas on how to solve it? And that's what we do. We do it every day.
So let's go to the phone. We've got a quick call, 328-5729. Tom has a question about the point in time count. Hi, Tom. You're on the air.
Oh, hi, Tom Robinson here, and I'm a member of the Spokane Homeless Coalition.
Hi, Tom. How are you?
Yeah, hi, Maurice. I can put in a plug for them. If you're helping anybody who's nearly homeless or homeless, you need to get on the Spokane Homeless Coalition page and get their emails. Now, my question actually is for Mr. Lewis. Before I ask that question, though, I want to respond to what the mayor said this morning in a Facebook live feed, where he discounted the feeding of homeless people outside of normal soup kitchens. And he downplayed that as not being very effective. What he doesn't know is that today we recalculated the numbers, and we feed people in front of the warming centers. I believe we feed in front of four or five warming centers a night, sometimes two meals a night. And we have fed people over 35,000 meals this winter outside those warming centers. Now, if the mayor wants to say you're not doing anything good standing on a street corner, he can hold that opinion, but he needs to come out and serve some people like I'll be serving people tonight. Now, my question for Mr. Lewis is partially answered by him tonight, and I appreciate the way that he explained that the schools count students who are homeless different from what he's counting, which are people who were sheltered or unsheltered, the kind of homeless persons you normally think of. Activists who look at the numbers of homeless students, which is several thousand that the school district has counted, because they're couch surfing or they're somehow living not with their family. And then there are another whole group of families that are living with other families that have been taken in by charitable families, and they are not counted by Mr. Lewis's count that he's talking about. So what happens is that there are 3,000 to 5,000 in estimated numbers of homeless in Spokane. And what annoys us activists is that the city very shortly will announce their count, and they will say that there are probably around 1,500 or thereabouts homeless persons in Spokane. And they will not say, but we believe that there are 3,000 to 5,000 actual homeless persons in Spokane. Now, I'd like Mr. Lewis to explain what he's going to do about that.
Sure. Well, and I can appreciate the perspective. I think probably answering your question, I'll have to point out the fact that part of this is meeting a federal mandate. So annually, we're required in order to be eligible to receive federal funding to conduct the point-in-time count. And it's a fairly prescribed methodology that we have to follow with some discretion to try novel approaches such as what we did this last couple years with the mobile data collection. So the report and the numbers that we post are really in reference to that federally mandated required report. And the scope of what's reported is limited to that. That isn't us or the city saying that there aren't other definitions of homelessness out there or that other households or individuals could meet those other definitions. And in fact, to a certain extent, even though the Department of Education has a different definition, even under HUD's definition, we are able to serve some of those households. It's about what, again, it's about meeting our federal reporting mandate, complying with those methodologies, not discounting that there are others that are meeting different definitions of homelessness, but trying to, I think, maintain the scope.
Another question, Tom?
I appreciate that. What concerns us is that at no point does when the city officials bring out this point in time count results, at no point do they state what Mr. Lewis just stated. They do not make it clear to the public that they're only counting a small segment, maybe less than one third of the homeless people that are out there in Spokane.
Can I weigh in on
that? Sure,
yeah. So I'm afraid I'm going to have to disagree with you because we did have a series of trainings, and I believe you might have been at one of those where we have stated.
The previous year.
Okay. Well, even at the previous year, we've stated, and I know that I myself have stated at many of those trainings and publicly, that this is not discounting those other definitions that are out there, that this is a HUD approved methodology, that the basis under which we conduct the count is following those guidelines and methodology. It's not trying to discount, again, that there's others out there that might be considered homeless under other definitions. Homelessness is a very difficult subject, and as often happens with those kind of subjects, there's a lot of perspectives and definitions that go with it. So, I appreciate your perspective on it, but I am going to have to disagree with you on that point.
Thank you for the call, Tom. 328-5729 is the number if you have a question for David Lewis from the Spokane Community Housing and Human Services Department and Maurice Smith from the Spokane Homeless Coalition. So I have a question that was asked during our forum last week. What gaps do you see in housing and homeless services that are offered in Spokane? Where are the areas that could use some bolstering?
Well, I'm probably going to stick my foot in it here. But anytime you're dealing and commenting on homeless policy and things that are going on and where are the gaps, we're about to close down the warming centers. They're going to phase out. Here's my question. Where are those folks going to go? Rob McCann from Catholic Charities made a great point at the forum the other night. I was there and thoroughly enjoyed it. I thought it was a good, vigorous discussion. That's what we need as a community. We need every side represented. But Rob made the point that when Catholic Charities was running House of Charity 24/7 shelter, that all of a sudden the number of homeless people on the street went noticeably down. And then when they were no longer able to continue that, because it was wearing the staff out, the building out, and the neighborhood out, it's tough work. When they discontinued, all of a sudden the visible presence of homeless people on the street went up. Well, if you don't have a place to go during the day, where are you going to go? Well, you're going to go to the library, or you're going to go to the transit plaza, or you're going to walk River Park Square. Mm-hmm. Why? Because you need a place to go. So I'm going to put this out there, and I'll probably get shot for it, but I think the gap that we have right now is for a large enough day shelter for people on the street where they can go be safe, do laundry, take a shower, lock their belongings up, and meet with caseworkers in a neutral location. When you're dealing with homeless people, a lot of times asking them to come where you are doesn't work. You have to go to where they are. If we had an operating day shelter where these folks could go during the day, get off of the street, get help with whatever their issues are, and again, be able to shower, be able to use a restroom, be normal people, what you and I think of as normal, that would be huge. And I, in my own personal opinion, I don't speak for the Spokane Homeless Coalition. I'm speaking for me. Having been at this almost 15 years, this is my perspective. We need a fully functional operating day shelter that can accommodate 200 to 300 people. That's a huge chunk to bite off. But we keep running into this when you do patchwork solutions, mm-hmm. and the patches come off, then everybody's going, well, what just happened? Well, isn't anybody thinking long term? The warming centers are going to shut down. Where are these folks going to go? So that's Maurice's beef right now, the burr in my saddle. I served for 10 years, over 10 years, on the board of Truth Ministries Men's Shelter. I know what it's like to have to ask guys to leave at 7 o'clock in the morning, hit the street. Why? Because running a day shelter is expensive. I have had a personal conversation, eye-to-eye, nose-to-nose, with a major ministry leader here in the city who has told me, we would love to run a day shelter.
But it's just too expensive?
His point was, but they have to pay us for it. Yeah. And the reason is because it is, like at Truth Ministries, when I was on the board there, we would shut down for 2 months during the summer. Why? To repair and clean everything. I've got pictures of my wife and I doing the laundry. You've got to strip all the beds. You've got to pull the beds to the center of the room. You've got to go literally corner to corner, side to side, cleaning, scrubbing. You'd be amazed because it's left behind in a men's shelter. It's intensive. And so that's why I feel that we need a day shelter that's not the night shelter. Why? Because the staff needs a break. You don't have time to clean and get stuff straight, fix stuff that got broken. People throw things, break things. It's hard work.
So we had the mayor on two nights ago, David. You're not he's the policymaker. You're the staff. Right. But I just had my card here.
Like I said, I probably just stepped
question.
In it.
In talking about the same thing from 7 a.m. to 7 p.m., is this something that you think is on the city's agenda as a possibility?
Well, I know that there's a lot of solutions that are being considered.
But it all comes down to money.
Well, I think money certainly plays a factor. But what I've appreciated, especially working at the city for as long as I have, is just how dedicated staff are, particularly in my department and the administration, in trying to find viable solutions. And I think what can seem like an easy, well, why don't they just do it tomorrow? Well, once you peel back that layer, there's a lot of complexity involved in being able to do anything. And, you know, I'm a member of the public too. And I think we've all like, you know, go, why don't they just do X? You know, and I think the reality is a lot more complicated than that. What I can tell you is that there's a lot of people putting in very long days trying to figure out how do we meet this need? And that same conversation's playing out. I think recently just over in Seattle, you know, with the whole Seattle is dying story. So, I mean, this isn't just a Spokane problem. It's something that we're all dealing with.
So I was going to raise that same issue. I have not seen the documentary yet, but I'm told it's fairly grim. What has been tried in Seattle? They've tried they've tried tiny houses in other places. They've tried homeless camps. They've tried Seattle and homeless camps. Mm-hmm. What do you think of those things that have been tried in other places? What do you think would work there that wouldn't work here? Or what do you think are the areas that would work? Would the tiny houses idea, would Spokane tolerate a homeless camp, an outdoor homeless camp with tents and that sort of stuff?
Well, you know, it's I'm thinking specifically of our recent five-year RFP that we just put out. We didn't actually get any responses that are structured around providing that as an option. So the city funds the service providers. The service providers submit their application saying, we think this is a viable option, will be successful. Here's how we're going to measure that success, which is where I come in because I'm on the data side of things primarily. But we didn't actually get any, despite that strategy that's been tried in Seattle and elsewhere, we didn't get any responses from service providers, which I don't know necessarily what that says about that as a policy. But under our current model, which, again, service providers tell us what the services they're going to provide and how they're going to do it, and we fund it, we didn't see that.
So one of the questions I've been hearing an awful lot is that question of, is Spokane's homelessness problem worse or is it just more visible? What are your thoughts, Maurice, about that?
That's almost a which came first, the chicken or the egg question.
Or is it a moot point?
I think we need to stop focusing on how big the problem is and start focusing on creative collaborating to solve the problem, regardless of what size it is. Certain things can be scaled up. Mm-hmm. And so it's not so much an issue of the numbers. It's the issue of having a plan. Where are you going? And what's your plan to get there? At our next coalition meeting, April the 4th, Thursday, April the 4th, up at the Gathering House, we're going to have the Continuum of Care Committee, which is a standing committee of service providers that is working on their revising a five-year plan for ending homelessness in Spokane. And we're the coalition is hosting the meeting because the committee wants to get input from service providers, more service providers. Again, we'll probably have 150 people at the meeting to talk about areas, teens or youth, adults, veterans, and there are a couple more categories. And we're going to break into working groups. And so if your interest is homeless veterans and serving veterans, then the subcommittee person for veterans will be there. And it's just going to be discussion on, okay, what are we going to do to solve homelessness among veterans? In the same way with youth, what are the new ideas to work with youth? What are the new ideas to work with women or with men? And so that's going to be a big meeting, and it is a place it's a place for honest, open discussion without getting hostile. Mm-hmm. Let's get together and talk. It's the old I don't know if you remember watching Apollo 13 with Tom Hanks when they're a great movie, and the guy who's Capcom, he's the flight director, Gene Kranz, he says, "Work the problem, people. Work the problem." That's we need to quit working the people, and we need to start working the problem and begin asking creative folks who've had some experience to come together and say, what are some new ideas? They may not work, but let's put them on the table. Let's talk about them, and let's collaborate as a community. That's what we're going to try and do with the documentary, is show people collaborating. How are we coming together to solve the problem of homeless families? How are we coming together to solve the problem of teens on the street or of employment for the difficult to employ? What are we? There are great things happening out there. Let's come together and talk about it and collaborate on it. So I don't think it's so much a numbers issue as it is, what's our plan? Let's work on creative ideas. And then if there are ideas that we can ramp up to meet the numbers, then great, let's go for it.
So, David, he mentioned the numbers. And if the, you know, do we define the homeless problem by the number of people who are homeless, or is there a different definition?
This is something I've always struggled with, because I think that there's a tendency to view this as a static number or something that you can whittle away at, if you will, when really what we know is homelessness is episodic. We have
it's dynamic, too. It's always changing.
It's always changing, and that you can enter and exit homelessness many times, and that's a product of a lot of things. But the struggle I have is I think that we need to look to Maurice's point. You know, is how do we collaborate together more effectively? And one thing that I would like to see more part of the conversation, yes, I'm biased, is technology. How does that play a role in this? And there's a lot of exciting work going on throughout the country with local HMIS, Homeless Management Information System platforms that have pivoted from what I would call a reporting platform into a direct case management platform that bridges all these different agencies together. So if you have an agency that excels in a particular service intervention, they're part of this network of providers that play to their strengths, and that's what I think we need to think about when we're talking about the number of homeless that are out there.
All right, so there's an app for everything. So could you conceive of an app being created where and many of the homeless people have their own phones and that
they
sort
do.
Of thing, where they could, you know, they could download the app, they could dial into the app, and somebody's on the other end who could answer a question or do something like that in the same way that you were getting real-time
yes.
information from your people who were asking and doing questionnaires. Is that a possibility?
Not only is that a possibility, I think that's where we have to go. Yeah. Because we need to treat those that are experiencing homelessness. We need to meet them where they're at. And we also need to be able to maintain that connection. And I don't know how you do that when you have these awesome service providers. I mean, part of the reason I stay in the community is I get to interact with some of the very best people. But they need help too. And there's only so much capacity. So how do we increase the capacity? How do we maintain that connection? And for me, it's a technology solution.
You know, we have a system. I've not used it because I'm not a caseworker. I'm moving from the hands-on guy to kind of the visionary, bigger picture guy to say, let's take a picture of this and see what it looks like, and then get people to look at that picture and figure out how we can fix it. But we have an information system. It's an intake system. And David, you will remember the abbreviation for it, but it's a family comes in and they are interviewed at Catholic Charities or whoever else is on the system, and they are put in a system that all of the major shelters are on, mm-hmm. and all of their information is there, and then an attempt is made to say, okay, it looks like these guys over here are the ones you need to talk to.
That would be our HMIS.
Yeah.
Yeah, our coordinated assessment system.
Yeah, the coordinated intake system. If there is a way to develop that coordinated intake system further to where some of that intake can be done with an app, or
yes.
it's coordinating information so that people, you know, some people have a difficult time making it to a location for mm-hmm. that intake. Now, at some point, they've got to do a personal interview, but just being able to maybe do an initial intake of some kind. I want to back up. Technology will help us. We need to remember where we're at. And I mentioned this when we were off the air. We saw back in November how one free turkey dinner could make a difference in the lives of 11,000 people. That was Tom's Turkey Drive. Mm-hmm. You know, kudos to Crim 2 and Tom's Turkey Drive. That tells us what the bubble of poverty and homelessness potentially is in the greater Spokane area, that one meal would make that much of a difference in the life of an individual or a family. we need to keep our eye on that ball. We're not just working to help the 1,245 from last year's count. We've got to be thinking about how poverty is dynamic, homelessness is dynamic, and by that I mean people can move in and out of it. And the people who are homeless this year, if we got them all housing, the numbers would go down, and then they'd go back up. They'd go back up at the next economic downturn. Or they would go up because there was some trauma to the system, and all of a sudden we've got 300 or 400 people coming into the system that have never been there before. And so we've got to think dynamically in terms of how do we prevent that, but also how do we absorb it, meet the need, and move people back out of homelessness as quickly as possible.
It's 6:36. Our guests are Marie Smith and David Lewis. If you want to jump in with a question, you can call 328-5729. We'll see if we can get you on the air. So a month or so ago, maybe it was a couple of months ago, there was a city council was talking about sort of imploring, I think, leaders in the surrounding communities to also deal with their own homeless problems. And there's a question from our forum from last week. As Spokane continues to better address this issue of homelessness, do you anticipate more individuals moving into the area for better services? And how do you get ahead of this? Is there a way to count that as part of the city of Spokane's homeless count?
Do small surrounding communities count, Dave?
Do they
their own count?
Well, I mean, technically, our whole Spokane County is our whole continuum.
Okay.
The question, and I call it the question because I get that a lot. We do ask, where were you living when you were last permanently housed? That question itself is a little bit loaded, right? Mm-hmm. I mean, as far as how do you define those things? And I think that's the challenge I have with it. I mean, no matter how we ask the question, overwhelmingly we find, and based on last year's numbers, we had, I think, around 72%. Identified as being from our region, our area. So we've asked the question every year, and we find every year that the majority identify as being from the Spokane area. To me, and I'm just speaking, you know, just as a citizen here, to me it's about how do we help the people. That should be, in my mind, the priority. I mean, it's certainly for planning purposes, if a case can be made that we need to identify where somebody is from because it helps provide them better services, okay. You know, I think you can make a case for that. But I worry somehow that because there's finite capacity to collect data, that sometimes we collect data that maybe doesn't support the work we're trying to do.
Another question. Why do the city and county not coordinate with each other on affordable and homeless housing? Maybe this would assist the nonprofits. It sounds to me like that's maybe an erroneous conclusion or assumption. Hmm. What are you saying?
I'm not an expert on housing. What I do know is that with the tightness of the housing market, it's countywide. By countywide, I mean city, county, you know, from border to border. We've got a vacancy rate, especially for rentals, which is where the homeless community and the low-income poverty community are primarily going to be, is in rentals. And by the way, in case anybody's wondering, my wife and I rent a two-bedroom apartment in Spokane Valley. And so when rental rates go up by 25%, as ours have, we feel the bite too. So I'm just saying that to let people know, no, I don't live, you know, up on the South Hill and in a palatial mansion. Nope, we live in a little small bedroom, two-bedroom apartment in Spokane Valley. Housing is tight regardless. We have two needs. One, we do need low-barrier housing for high-barrier individuals. Mm-hmm. By high-barrier, I mean they've got issues. Mm-hmm. We need more housing for those individuals. But in addition to the housing, and we're already seeing this manifest, we need ongoing wraparound supportive services for high-barrier people that we put into low-barrier housing. If we don't, we will have slums in 10 years. That's not Maurice being mean. That's telling you what is already in process as we speak, because high-barrier people have issues. They need ongoing wraparound services to help them come out. Generational poverty and homelessness is something that takes, in fact, I wish Joe Ader were here because he could talk about this. there's like 17 or 19 steps that have to come together to get someone out of homelessness slash poverty. It's everything from ID restoration to its health to its income to its housing. There are about, I think Joe has a list of about 19 of those that people have to, they've all got to come together. And so if you get someone into housing, but you've only solved 10 of the 19, it may be number 11 that kicks them back into homelessness, and now they're starting all over again. And we don't want to see that happen. We want to see people succeed long term. And if that's going to happen, we need not just, it's not just about low barrier housing for high barrier people. It's about supportive services to see to it that they make it all the way up that ladder to the last rung to where they can say, I've got my life back. That's where we want them to be.
Do you think the moral issues of drug use, the perceived weakness of that, and, you know, we're perfectly happy to help the mom who was a victim of domestic violence or something like that, but the guy who's down deeply enmeshed in a drug habit and just trying to get by from day to day, does that attitude of one is worthy and one is not get in the way of dealing with this issue?
My buddy Mark Terrell had a cup of cool water, been working with street kids for 25 years. Love Mark, very down to earth, graduate of Whitworth University here in town. He taught me a principle that I put in the documentary that people will see, and I use it. I used it with a class at WSU last night. I said, remember this. Here's what Mark Terrell taught me. How we see people is the beginning of how we treat people. If we see people, if we see someone and they may be addicted to drugs and we label them as a drug addict, he's a druggie. What I've done, and maybe true, they may be on drugs. Okay, he is. But what I've done is I've given myself emotional permission to think less of this individual and to begin treating him or her as something less than my equal. As a Christian, I believe that every man, woman, and child is created in the image of God. And I told a class at Gonzaga a couple of months ago, I said, look, if God loved him enough to create him, he expects me to love him enough to serve them and to help them in their time of need. And that's what I have to live by.
Can I weigh in on that too?
Yeah, absolutely.
Because I agree with everything Maurice said. One of the ways I try to explain this to people is, and I've heard those opinions, right? They don't deserve it.
Yeah.
I hear that a lot. And I think you can make a moral argument. I think you should just help people regardless. Yeah. But the another argument you could take is, regardless of how you feel, it's cheaper as a society. And you know, you're, well, I don't want my tax dollars to go to that. Regardless of how you look at it, that person's going to rely on emergency services.
Absolutely.
They're going to be using ER rooms. So even if somebody doesn't subscribe to the humanitarian argument, which makes me sad because we should, there's a very real and really hard to argue with, because you can't really argue with the facts, that it's just cheaper. It makes more sense from a public policy perspective.
Yeah, just the economics of it are, you're absolutely right.
So let's go to the phone. William is on to talk about service providers. Hi, William.
Dude, hey, your panel's just awesome, man.
Thanks.
Yeah, so great to be listening on the radio, and then all of a sudden I talk to the lady, and then I'm hearing you guys on the phone, and then you answered my call. So I just want to tell you, you guys are awesome. I don't know your two names. I want to make a reference to the guy that said Gene Kranz worked the problem from Apollo 13.
Right.
That was just a great, great comment right there. And seriously, everything you're saying, and I just want to kind of turn it on its head a little bit. I was telling the screener that I've, I've given out meals and I've had to go to the mission. I've been to, homeless shelters where I told them the next day I'd rather go to jail. I mean, it's run so poorly. And nothing against them or anybody else. It's just, I know it's a, when you're looking at it as a problem instead of an opportunity. And I just like to say a couple things. One thing, if our people are greatest value, the most valuable resource that we have. Then you've got an army of people that come through here all the time. They're looking for some clothes, a freaking place to sleep, and I'm sure they'd be glad to freaking, you know, help if you had to refurbish a home or a this or a that. You got people that can probably cook a sandwich, and then there's other people who need help. I can see that when I felt like I was just shuffled in, and here's your freaking bed, and see you out, and I'm in the morning, they're right, it was a freaking crappy-ass mess, and I hated going to that bathroom and having to try to figure out how 12 guys managed to shave, and none of them thought about the fact that there's a guy coming after him. Anyway, those are things that I think that, like what you were just saying about when it's looked at like, you know, you don't want to help people, you don't want to, you know, give charity or something like that. I don't want to look at it as charity. I want to look at it as the fact that anybody has to be walking in there and know that Spokane has an idea, that there's a place you can go. I love the thing about the intake where you could, like, have the app. These are some really good ideas that you got. Anyway, some of the things I had written down, instead of a huge 200 people place, they have a couple different places throughout the city where, you know, if you're north or south or whatever, that once you go in there, you know, if there's guys that are in and out or you know, I you guys know the people and the resources better than I do. God, to hear about your service providers, they sound like they got the biggest hearts in the world, and Spokane has a lot of good ideas, and I'd love to share those and come to your meeting on the 4th. So I was really, really so happy that you got me to call. I got a lot of different ideas. I had been writing down ideas before this and was planning on coming to that last meeting, but I didn't make it. So anyway, just I want to tell you what a great job you're doing, and if people are our biggest resource, then the people that are just happen to be hanging around, yeah, if they had a, you know, like you said before, you have a full belly and some clean clothes and your clothes, and you got a freaking place to sleep one night. I'm telling you, the next day you could have somebody who has answers, and you know, one guy knows how to freaking build a shelf, another guy knows how to put in a light. You know,
sorry, I gotta. You said the word you couldn't say on the radio.
That's right.
Sorry about that. But, William, appreciate your enthusiasm there.
I appreciate the flattery. Flattery gets you everywhere
there
in my book.
So let's go back to the phones. Smith is on to talk about, I think, coordinating between the city and the county. Hi, Smith.
Hi. How are you?
How are you?
I appreciate you taking my call. I appreciate you addressing this subject matter because it's an important one in our community and communities across our state. As an affordable housing developer who's worked on homeless issues in both Washington and Oregon, though, one of the concerns I have had in the past and still do is the coordination of funding opportunities between the city and the county and or the lack thereof. You know, I think better gains are made when everybody's working together and there's transparency to what they're funding. That's my question or comment.
Okay. Got some thoughts, either guy?
I can't necessarily speak to that in its entirety, but I do want to point out, partly because I have the benefit of being part of the collaboration that is happening between the city and the county, I can tell you that that there is a lot of effort that has gone into that, continues to go into that, to finding ways that we can work together, kind of especially to Maurice's point, you know, being part of a solution. And I've been impressed with the leadership that we've seen from the county, particularly those that are involved on the affordable housing side. So, I mean, it just as an insider's perspective, it's I know that that collaboration's happening, and I know that there's efforts to find solutions.
Maurice, thoughts about that?
Well, collaboration is a good, probably well defined as a joint work in progress. Mm-hmm. Spokane doesn't have all of its answers yet, but the fact that we are talking more about it, that we're getting the issue out in front of your listeners, mm-hmm. other stations, mm-hmm. Schools, colleges, universities, ordinary folks who work for a living and they have good hearts and would love to be involved in a solution, the fact that we're talking publicly about it and giving them the opportunity to hear and to think and to respond, that's what is going to eventually, I think, and hopefully I'm not being overly optimistic, generate the solutions that we need, is everybody bringing their A game to the table and saying, here's what I've got, what can I do to be part of the solution?
Question from a listener, how has Spokane's Housing First program worked? Finland has solved its homeless issues through Housing First. How much would this cost?
The issue there for me right off the bat is I'd have to go to Finland and see what they're doing. For example, now we're back to the discussion we had just a few minutes ago about supportive services. And you have cultural differences. I don't know what the, besides language.
We're going to have to send you to Finland.
Okay, honey, pack your bags. We're going. We'd have to see what they're doing, how they did it, what are the cultural differences that won't transfer, and then what about the supportive services? Because, again, if you're putting high-barrier people into low-barrier housing, they are going to need ongoing help. And because we're already experiencing that. So Housing First, in my mind, can work. I like the idea. What I don't like is the idea that 10 years from now we may be going, oh, my word, we've created a slum because we did not give those people everything they needed to be successful. Here's something I learned at a workshop this years ago. A friend of mine, George Barna, was leading the workshop. And he did a workshop on revolutionary leaders, and he made a point, made several, but this one has stuck in my mind all these years. He said, revolutionary leaders set people up for success in their absence. In other words, a good leader sets the people he leads up to succeed after he is gone. So my question is this. What are we doing for the people we're putting into Housing First and other homeless individuals struggling that we're helping? We're going to put them into housing. How are we setting them up for success once we leave? And when is that leave? Is it the month after, 6 months later, a year later? But what are we doing? We've got to, I think, got to keep that in the forefront of our mind. That is, am I setting these people up for success? And if not, I'm shooting myself in the foot. I'm shooting my community in the foot because it means we'll have to revisit this issue with these folks again, and it'll be worse. So let's get it right and set these folks up for success.
I completely agree.
Don't do that, David.
No,
come on.
I completely agree. But I do want to say that I think that we found the solution that works with Housing First. I don't know of an alternative approach. We know that putting people in emergency shelters, that doesn't solve the problem. It doesn't meet their needs. So I think we found the solution that works, but we need to tweak it. We need to find – I mean, this is complicated. I mean, needs are complicated. And I do think that a lot of those solutions are going to rest in how we structure our service model. And again, here's that bias come in. I think it's also where we intelligently apply technology to help them. And to me, it's the force multiplier effect. We're always going to have fewer caseworkers than we need, I feel.
Yeah, we've got great universities here in the area, and that means there's some great young tech minds out there. Hey, guys, gals, come to the table. We need the tech. We need the apps. We need that behind-the-scenes infrastructure that only you can create. I can't do it. I'm an old guy. You know, if I can't just push the button and have success, I don't want to use it. I did my master's on a Smith Corona Super 12 electric typewriter. So
I don't even know what that is.
Oh, I do. I do. You don't want to use one. I got through graduate school on it.
Another listener question. What opportunities are there to volunteer and get involved in the solution? Well, I'm sure you've got some volunteer ideas, Maurice.
Well, first, get involved. I've got a saying that I use at the end of segment two of the documentary, and I'll just put it out there. We can't change what we don't love. We can't love what we don't know. And we can't know what we're unwilling to invest with our time, our effort, and our resources. So start at the bottom of that list. What are you doing to invest some time, effort, and resources in getting to know the problem? If you want to volunteer, what's your passion? What do you want to do? You want to work with teens? You want to work with homeless families? Who do you want to work with? Where's your passion? Find that first. And then where are you going to invest some time, some effort, and maybe some money so you get to know people? And as you get to know them, you will eventually come to love them. And once you love them, it's a lot easier to change them because it's a different dynamic. And so if you're looking at volunteering, you know, the goal of our documentaries that we're going to be doing is to hopefully mobilize the community. Here's the issue. Now, let's look at some great things that people are doing to address this problem, and why don't you get involved? You've seen what they're doing. You've seen the problem. You've seen what people are doing. Now, what are you going to do? It's time for you to get involved. But start at that lowest rung, and that is, what's your passion? Where do you want to invest your time, your effort, and your resources to get to know the problem, the issue? Once you get to know the issue, you'll eventually come to I love homeless people. Some of my best friends are people that I've met in homeless shelters. We stay in touch. Why? I love them. They're my friends. And when you are in a love relationship with people, they change and you change. That's Maurice's two cents for what it's worth.
So, David, you had volunteers working with you on during that week of counting the homeless. Are there other opportunities for people to get involved?
I think there's always opportunities to get involved. I really appreciate what Maurice was saying there. I know that one of the goals that I have, and this is just a personal goal in my role as the HMIS program manager, is I would like to get to a place, and I think with the tech we're getting there, where we could do more than one count a year. I think that that's something that we would definitely need volunteers for. I really appreciate. In fact, it's impossible without the volunteers that we have. I appreciate the passion. But for me, the mission is really understanding, is achieving that deeper understanding. And I think the more data that we have, the more we can achieve in that understanding. So I think if I was going to point to one specific future volunteering effort I would like to see is maybe a count in the summer, because looking at the seasonal variation. So
how do you anticipate it would be different?
Well, that's the question.
We don't know.
Yeah, yeah,
so. Never done it before.
We haven't done that before. But we know that, I listen to our service providers because they're experts. They know. Anecdotally and otherwise, we've heard, youth as a population could fluctuate seasonally. That I think would be worth pursuing. Just in volunteering in general, the Spokane Homeless Coalition, I mean, it's funny, they meet at the Gathering Place. So it's a gathering that meets at the Gathering Place, which I like. And it's
there is an irony there.
the atmosphere, everything about it is a good environment. If you have a passion, you're going to find an opportunity to apply that passion.
And just rubbing shoulders with people you've never met before but who share your passion, you get to network, I've learned so much. I thought I knew something about serving the homeless, the poor, and the marginalized. And the more involved I've gotten with the coalition and watched it work, I just go, wow, this is like a graduate education in how to network and collaborate and work with people. You may not go to church together, but you'll meet first Thursday of every month, and you'll stand shoulder to shoulder, and you'll say, hey, what are you guys doing this month? And so that's a community. That's what we do.
That's Maurice Smith from the Spokane Homeless Coalition. Just real quick, will we be able to see your documentary anytime soon?
I will let you know. We're in the final edits right now. We've gone from 10 hours of footage down to about 56 minutes. We're in the final edits, and my editor sent me an email today and said, we're almost done. So I'm hopeful. We've got technical stuff, color mixing, sound mixing, that kind of stuff, which is you save for last. And that's where we're at. And I'm looking forward to a preview in the very near future.
And David Lewis is the Homeless Management Information Systems Manager for the City of Spokane's Community Housing and Human Services Department. Thanks, guys, for both being here.
Thank you.